Good evening. Today is 9/11.
Yes, today.
So a day of much violence in the past based on wrong views, we might say. So let's dedicate our practice intentions tonight to world peace, and may such misguided violence not happen more on this planet. If we look at that 9/11 event in relation to taking refuge in the three treasures, it's interesting. I don't think we should go so far as to say the fact that they weren't Buddhist was the problem. That's too narrow. Yeah. But in fact, we could say some version of Buddha as the kind of like wholesome goal and heart and source of any religious tradition. We don't have to call Buddha, but wisdom and compassion combined, always inseparable. If we rely on, take refuge in this united wisdom and compassion, I think this prevents violence. And then the Dharma teachings of any religion that aim in that direction also seem to support nonviolence. And the Sangha, a community of like-minded people to help guide us when our ideas seem really not peaceful and unviolent, can go a long way. So whatever religious traditions there are, may they find some equivalent to the three treasures to prevent great harm and find great peace. I came across this teaching in a book by actually non-Buddhist teacher. I'm very moved by these days, Rupert Spira. Yeah. Coming from a kind of like maybe Advaita Vedanta angle, but he doesn't really use religious language at all. But to me it seems completely in accord with particularly Buddha nature teachings, the way he talks. And his chapter in his book called Presence is called Our True Security. And this is, when we look up refuge in the dictionary, it defines it as a place of security or safety. So this is in a non-Buddhist context, but I thought it's a beautiful expression of, I think, most aligned with this one-bodied triple treasure, the kind of ultimate Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and Buddha nature as empty present awareness or presence. Somebody asks Rupert, in exploring our direct experience, I often wonder how much we can trust it. So that's basically the gist of this question. What can we trust? What is our true security? This is this question. And part of the reply here is like this. Whatever is truly real and present in our experience must be without appearance or disappearance. It must be changeless. That is, it must be ever-present. It must know itself and be its own cause. That's what must be truly real and present. And I think by implication, secure and trustworthy. Because anything that comes and goes is by definition not trustworthy. Yeah. I mean, Rachel and I were talking a little bit about impermanence. We could trust impermanence itself, the fact of impermanence, being trustworthy, because that impermanence never changes. Impermanence never becomes permanent. So, and there's something trustworthy about impermanence, I think. But impermanent phenomena that are coming and going cannot be truly real and trustworthy, is what's being said here. So,
what's real?
Well, then he goes on to say, so we can now simplify our question and ask, is there anything in our experience that is ever-present, changeless, self-illuminating, self-knowing, and self-causing? It sounds like some of the language that Asanga uses in his definition of Buddha. He talks about it's self-illuminating and ever-present, unchanging. Almost same language as this Mahayana description of Buddha. And Rupert says, the answer is yes, our own being, aware presence. Our self is the reality that runs unchanging throughout all experience. Our self here, meaning like true, ungraspable self, not the ego, separate self. Only this ever-present, changeless, and aware self can be absolutely trustworthy. An intermittent object cannot, by definition, be worthy of absolute trust, because on what would we place our trust when it was absent? And if it disappears, then what do we trust now? Trust or hold on to that self or aware presence alone. Even we might say, really hold on to? But I think it's maybe okay to even say, hold on to this, not in some grasping kind of way, but hold it as a refuge, because it's not a phenomena that we can actually grasp anyway.
Mm-hmm. So this is a we could put Buddha nature.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Aware presence. However. So he says, trust or hold on to that self or aware presence alone. However, what could hold on to that? Obviously, an intermittent object, such as a personal self, cannot hold on to the ever-present reality of our experience. So an apparent separate self cannot hold on to aware presence. In other words, I, the one I think as me as the separate self, cannot really take refuge, strictly speaking, in the boundless awareness itself. Aware presence alone can hold on to itself. It is all that is present there throughout its own ever-presence. However, it is already itself, so there's no need for it to make an effort to hold on to itself. Aware presence cannot lose itself. It cannot not be itself. Therefore, in order to know that element of our experience that is worthy of trust, all that is needed is to abide as the present awareness that we always already are. The aware presence that we already are. This simple knowing of our own being is the irreducible and indestructible reality of our experience. That is the only certainty, our true security.
Could one say aware permanent presence? It's not permanent because mm-hmm. I mean we're moving, mm-hmm. but it's permanently present.
Yeah, we can say that. In fact, it's a dangerous word in Buddhism,
yes.
And yet the Mahayana teaches.
We are not.
Yeah, we're not permanent, but it is. Yeah, and there's some. You know, this is where the Buddhist tradition can have internal debates within itself. But in fact, the Mahayana sutras, particularly the Mahayana Mahaparinirvana Sutra, talks about Buddha, is it one of the main Buddha nature sutras? Yeah. And it talks about Buddha nature having these qualities of permanence, which is, you know, we're used to hearing the Buddha in the early teachings says, all phenomena are impermanent, they're no self, they're not satisfactory, they're kind of marked by suffering, and they're impure, or means like they're dualistic projection, we could say. But in this Parinirvana Sutra, the Buddha says, talking about Buddha nature, it's the opposite of these. It's permanent. It is self, like capital S self, as opposed to no self. It is it is instead of unsatisfactory or suffering, it is bliss, blissful nirvana, free from suffering, and it is pure, meaning free of duality.
Would you say all inclusive?
Yeah, all inclusive. Yes. Yeah, all inclusive. I think it's nicely with purity in this case. So although you don't find that kind of teaching in early foundational Buddhism, the Mahayana is willing to say that Buddha is permanent. I think in this Asanga version, it maybe says free from permanence and impermanence, something like that.
It sounds like the idea of enlightenment to me. You know, like the,
yeah.
And the Buddha was a refuge of enlightenment.
Exactly.
Was, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, it is because Buddha means awakened or awakening. And in Buddha nature teachings, we say Buddha nature is enlightened awareness, ever-present already. Yes. That's the Mahayana twist. Enlightenment is already completely present and unadulterated, but it's kind of, we're not open to it because it's our habitual tendencies of dualistic thought are kind of blocking it. But it's not like there's an awakening that's not here that has to awaken.
Yeah.
We might say, well, removing the obscurations to awakening is what we call awakening. But, yes.
In what sense would you say a Zabutan is aware of itself?
I wouldn't. It's a phenomena, right? Only awareness is aware of itself. Right? Only, you know, which is a quality of sentient beings, which Zabutans are not. Only each of us has or even is. Dogen likes to change that. All beings have Buddha nature. He says all beings are Buddha nature. It's actually who we are, not some type of mind that we have. It's our who we are. And we could say the awareness that we are is we could call Buddha or Buddha nature. Well, strictly speaking, we could call it Buddha nature, which is sort of like a potential. And then when the obscurations to it are all dropped away, then we call it Buddha. Mm-hmm. And then we could say, we could get into these discussions about, from the perspective of this Buddha nature, from this ever-present awareness that has no objects, because then it would be dualistic, right? If it has no objects, that means that the Zabutan is not really an object of this awareness.
Mm-hmm.
It's from the point of view of awareness, it's not like awareness is aware of an external Zabutan. Then we would call it consciousness, like dualistic consciousness, right? But this non-dual awareness, by definition, must mean that all objects are it. Instead of it's aware of objects, the awareness and the objects are identical. That's what non-duality means. Self and objects are not two. Right, so in that case, we could say then the Zabutan, as we experience it from the point of view of awareness, which is the only real point of view, according to Buddha nature, the Zabutan is actually awareness. So it's not that it has awareness, it doesn't have a mind, but the way our awareness perceives the Zabutan is it's like a projection, right? It's not a projection, it's more like a manifestation, or it's an expression of our awareness.
Mm-hmm.
Or, as Rupert Spira likes to say, it's made of our awareness. But that doesn't mean that it has a mind or something.
As Zabutan doesn't have this, our six sense organs.
Yeah.
But it may have something we don't know about.
I'm hearing you say there's a fine line between sentient and insentient beings. And I'm hearing you say that I shouldn't listen to any talk about awareness because nothing, you know, the old thing, nothing outside of it can point to it without that just being actually consciousness. So.
Well, the words come in like dualistic packages, correct? Because they're describing phenomena. So it's true that words don't reach it, as we say, right? And yet, how else can we keep refining our understanding without words? Our understanding that goes beyond words, it just seems like... there are ways, I think, without words, but words are the usual one.
Yeah.
Usual way, the pointers, the fingers pointing to the moon.
Yeah.
So it's not like they're just useless. But like, can we rely on the words completely? Maybe if that would be a question, is can we take refuge in these words? Maybe not ultimately. Mm-hmm. I found another teaching that related to this point. Is that kind of something to do with your point?
Yeah, I'm just trying to just keep separating consciousness and awareness.
Yeah, consciousness again would be like the mind that has an object, a mind that maybe we should say a mind that actually believes that its objects are separate from it, maybe would be a better way to put it.
Like what Dogen says about we are Buddha nature, and in that way, for me, the way I think of it is like we are Buddha nature, and it's just really my job to get rid of the obscurations of those words and those concepts, and underneath all those things, in the midst of all that, appearance is where the Buddha nature exists.
Yeah, and I like how you just said, underneath all those things, which is often how we think of it, and even in the midst of. So it's actually not so much even getting rid of the obscurations, but we could see that actually the obscurations themselves are not really obscurations, right? They're also made of Buddha nature. Yeah, they're so. But see, it's a matter of seeing or a shift of perspective.
And that's what you mean by a higher self or a big self?
Big self, and even the Buddha sutras talk about self, capital S, as a name for this Buddha nature. Yes.
Is it possible to not bother distinguishing between sentient and non-sentient if we're not talking about consciousness, we're just talking about awareness? So rather than saying that the sabhitan is made of our awareness, can we just say the sabhitan is awareness as well?
Yeah, if we understand that to mean like it's like an expression of awareness, but if we say it has awareness, then we would start to, that at least most people would, I think, understand that to mean that it has some sort of, like, it's knowing us somehow.
Well, from Rupa Spira's position, nothing, we're not saying things have awareness anyway. We're just saying awareness permeates.
That's right.
And I guess I'm thinking about this.
We could even reverse it and say, it's not that we're a person that has awareness, it's more the other way, that awareness has us.
Exactly, right. That's exactly what I'm trying to say. In which case, I feel like it might just be safer not to draw a line saying between sentient and non-sentient, because we used to draw a line between humans and animals, and we also drew a line between animals and plants. And I feel like it can't do any harm, and it seems safer to just not exclude anything from awareness.
That's why I feel privileged to be, since I'm just a compounded phenomena, and the Zabutan's a compounded phenomenon, I feel privileged to be called something that can somehow no awareness without touching it, and the Zabudan. Sometimes just out of luck.
Is what I just said, does that resonate with you?
I'm just thrown off by words like has and are, has awareness, are awareness, etc. But I don't see the point of distinguishing between sentient and insentient, but it just leads to the kinds of problems that I was asking about.
Yeah.
What if we say there's nothing but awareness? There's nothing other than awareness, or Buddha nature, pervading the universe, or the universe itself is also just another expression of this Buddha nature. And then, in a way, we could say everything kind of equal is an equal expression of it. We might say from our, in a way, coming back into a somewhat conventional level of discussion, we might say, scientifically speaking, we might say it looks like that what we call sentient beings are the ones that are the ones that that can appreciate awareness through what we call sentience. Rocks and tiles and pebbles and zabutons, maybe they appreciate in their own way, right? But we can't understand so far how they might appreciate it. And therefore, also, I think another thing is you could say these Buddha Dharma is directed particularly towards people and, sometimes towards animals when we teach some Dharma to the crickets and stuff, right? But we could say, and it's because what we usually call sentient beings are the ones that suffer. I think that's a big part of it. And we could say, the Zabuton is suffering me, and it's saying, "You're squishing me, Kokyo, get off me." I think that's like a projection. Again, it can be open to, it might be suffering, but, in a way, I almost feel like it denigrates the Zabuton to say that it suffers. It's almost, I think we could say Zabuton is actually like above us, more in a way more evolved, because it never suffers and it doesn't need to hear these teachings about the Four Noble Truths and stuff. It's fine. But we, as so-called sentient beings, we suffer because we're confused about this consciousness thing.
Oh, that's very interesting. And no ignorance in the Zabuton.
Yeah.
No erroneous
beings. It's like... it's just perfectly expressing its Buddha nature, you could even say. But we need these teachings, and it looks like animals also seem to suffer in similar ways that we do when we look at them. They whimper and whine and howl, and we could.
More relational too.
They're more, yeah, yeah.
More involved in
yep.
Those
yeah. Yeah. So it seems like. But us sentient beings put them there.
We put them there.
Yeah. And they're like, "You sentient beings, we were fine where we were."
We will enlighten you.
I had a story. Some of you may have heard this. I haven't verified it or checked it out, but it sounds interesting. Somehow they were able to monitor trees to see if they have feelings, and they were able to somehow detect when trees were afraid. And they were afraid when people went by them in boots, leather boots that were from animals killed, and they agonized in their death, and the trees could feel that and express it. I'm not surprised to hear that. I didn't check out that story, but this is just about what we're talking about. There may be more sentience out there than we know.
I think there's a lot going on that
yes.
we don't know in this universe, yeah. So all-inclusiveness, nothing's excluded from awareness. And this teaching that I was going to mention about words, there's one... One of these traditional kind of breakdowns about Dharma, the second treasure, is there's the, I think it's called like the Dharma of Scripture and the Dharma of Realization. And it's the Dharma of Scripture is, and nicely you can put into these lists, right? So the Tripitaka, the Tripitaka is these three baskets of the Buddha teaching. The Vinaya, which is the, ethical conduct, forms and ceremonies and regulations for living, right? Then there's the sutras that are like the that are teaching in a way teaching meditation and so on. And then there's the Abhidharma, which is like kind of higher wisdom teachings. But those are that dharma is not like an ultimate refuge. That's the written dharma. But that's the basis for the dharma of realization, which is these three, sila, samadhi, and prajna. And they kind of go together with, you know, the vinaya is the dharma of scripture that actually leads to the realization of sila, which is ethical conduct, but through a person's way of being in harmony with others. And the sutras lead to the dharma of realization of samadhi, the meditational presence, and then the abhidharma written teachings leads to the dharma of realization of prajna or wisdom. So you could say the ultimate refuge is more the actual experience of sila, samadhi, and prajna, which is actually Dogen brings up right in these five skandhas, right, of a Buddha: sila, samadhi, prajna, liberation, and the knowledge and vision of liberation.
Reminds me of the paramitas. Talked about that last
week. Yeah, that's connected. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I thought that was a nice division too. Of there's the dharma of scripture, which we do take refuge in those words because they lead to this realization, and then there's the dharma of realization, which is almost like Buddha, almost flips back into the Buddha category or Sangha category.
I was saying last week, I can see myself taking refuge in the sutras because I really didn't know what they were saying.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought there was something, there had to be something there, but they've been around for that many years. And, you know, so it was that kind of hope. So.
Yeah.
Practicing, reading and chanting.
Mm-hmm. Another teaching I came across was about a refuge in the three treasures is a gateway to all paths of practice. Like if we're going to do any other practice, we kind of start with refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, or we don't really know where we're going. And faith, or we might say trust, opens the gateway to refuge. And then this teaching brought up these different types of faith or trust. And the first is just like faith with no reason, when you just like see a Buddha image, or you read a sutra but you don't quite understand it, like you said, or you see like a monk wearing a robe or something and you have some feeling about that. So it's not based on any like direct understanding, but yeah, but you still might be like, this is weird words in the sutra. But I remember when I first read Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind in high school, actually, this is really weird, and I don't understand it, but actually it's captivating. And I know that I'll come back to this. I kind of felt like, even though I didn't quite get it. So in a way, there was a little faith there. But that's the first type, and then next type of faith is like having really understood the problems with grasping, with problems with samsara, and greed, hate, and delusion. We see this really doesn't work, and the benefits of liberation or freedom from that. We just, even we don't know how to get there, but we see this really doesn't work so well, and this really works, and I see there's some teachings about this. It's like another next step in faith. It's not just totally blind faith anymore, right? And then this final kind of confident faith or trust is like a reasoned understanding about what the three treasures really are and how they can actually never really fail us. They're really completely worthy of confidence through reason and experience. So I think any place we can tap into like a little bit of faith, then that kind of deeper faith grows from that, and then eventually refuge. Kind of implying that refuge comes kind of later in the process, in the story, I think, is when we really see, oh, these three treasures are really, they can't fail me. I can fail them, but they can't fail me. Then there's like, then refuge almost like arises. Maybe it's when Dogen says, it's not that the sentient being can take refuge on her own, or the Buddha can just give you refuge, but in this kano doko, in this meeting of me and Buddha, mm-hmm. the refuge arises. So, shall we go continue with some Dogen? So we're on the top of page 2. Oh, here's a little note that I wrote here from, I listened to a talk from Tenzin Roshi this week, and it wasn't really about refuge, but this quote stood out. He said, if we go through a whole day without remembering what is most important to us, that is a risky day. That's a great quote, I thought.
Believing things are permanent.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're going to get upset.
Mm-hmm. That could be part of it, or are we just what's most important to us, like our true refuge, whatever that is what's most important to us. And if we forget that refuge, then we get involved in all these kind of like distractions, basically superficialities and sidetracks, and we've kind of lost touch with what's most important. So then we just do things based on our habits that maybe get us into a bunch of trouble. Whereas if we're remembering even sometime in the day, which is nice that we at the beginning of the morning here we take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. This is what's most important, we might feel. And then that kind of sets the stage for a day that's less risky.
It feels like more like it's either take refuge in the three treasures or neuroses.
No middle ground.
Yeah. I play with it. You know.
Yeah. Well,
who wins?
You know, actually, I agree with you. The more I practice, the more I feel like it's kind of like one or the other.
Yeah.
And of course our actual day is kind of this mix of, yeah, the monkey mind or forgetting that, that the obscurations are not made of awareness. Believing in the obscurations and getting caught up in them. Or not. And we go back and forth. So, the Lotus Sutra says, these beings, because of their unwholesome conditions, cannot hear the name of the three treasures, even for uncountable kalpas. So we actually chant this part of the Lotus Sutra on Friday evenings. Our translation says, the beings vexed with their offenses caused by their unwholesome karma through vast rounds of kalpas, hear not the name of the three treasures. Mm-hmm. And then the next line says, but those who practice virtuous deeds are gentle, upright, and sincere. These all see that I, the Buddha, exist, abiding here, proclaiming Dharma. Dogen dismisses the kind of negative part. Sutra has this kind of positive thing. But
kind of scarce.
Yeah.
The
very top of page 2. That's our translation that we chant on Friday of the same line from chapter 16 of the Lotus Sutra. And why is Dogen quoting this? Partly, I think, often when he writes these essays, he's just looking for every reference he can remember that has the three treasures in it.
Yeah.
But in another way, you could say it's not just a random line. I think we could hear it as if we hear the name of the three treasures and are here talking about the three treasures, we have this amazing karmic situation. We can rejoice that are in such a situation to open to wisdom teachings for whatever tradition, you know, because so many people don't have that fortune. And we might say, well, is that our luck? And Buddhist tradition would say, no, there's not really such thing as luck. It's karma and karmic conditions. We our aspirations, whether we're aware of them or not, this is like maybe the Kano Doko thing again, We want to be free from suffering. We're aware of that. We're looking for ways that work, and then we come across them because we look. People are like, I'm not suffering, so I don't need anything. They probably won't ever hear the name of the three treasures through, you know, past lives or this life. We can rejoice in, some might say, our merit, or we could say our karmic conditioning that brought us to an amazing practice that has so much potential, even if we feel like, oh, I'm really such a mess in this practice and I'm constantly failing. At least we have it. I even just have a little bit of trust in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. But that's maybe more than many people have. Mm-hmm. And if we keep practicing, it maybe grows. So.
Yes. I was reminded of a definition of luck being when preparation meets opportunity, which is like practice meets
other conditions.
Situation.
Yeah. We might even connect that phrase, preparation and opportunity, as connected to kano doko.
Yeah.
Like, we bring forward the preparation, we do something as the preparation, and the opportunity is like the other side, like Buddha offering something back.
It meets us.
Yeah, so it's a meeting.
Yeah.
The preparation and the opportunity meet in this mystical communion or this sympathetic resonance. And we could say all that is just causes and conditions. Yeah, is
right,
another way of talking
right,
about kano doko, actually. Dependent co-arising, I think, is another name.
What is it called?
Dependent co-arising.
Dependent co-arising, yes.
Mm-hmm. Another way of looking at this sympathetic resonance. Mm-hmm. And I think it's true that, like, if we're really just involved in a lot of unwholesome, just we really want to get back at people and we just want to just get as much as we can for ourselves, that we don't then tend to hang around places where these words Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha are floating around. and then the positive side, this next line of the Lotus Sutra, but those who practice virtuous deeds, this is the, not in the text here, but in what we chant of the Lotus Sutra. Those who practice virtuous deeds are gentle, upright, and sincere. These all see that I exist, the Buddha is saying. I truly exist, and I abide here. We can hear this as the ever-present awareness. I truly exist, and I abide here, and I'm proclaiming Dharma constantly. So we through this being virtuous, upright, gentle, and sincere, wholehearted, I think later in the sutra it says, wholeheartedly wishing to behold the Buddha, I really want to meet the Buddha, then they see that I am here on Vulture Peak and every other dwelling place. So then Dogen comments on this Lotus Sutra. He says, the Lotus Sutra describes the great causes and conditions of Buddha Tathagata's. Or another translation is, the Lotus Sutra is the great causes and conditions of Buddha Tathagata's. It's kind of nice. It kind of then makes the Lotus Sutra into a Buddha. Which, in fact, when we chant the 10 names of Buddha, actually there's 11 of them. And the 11th is the Lotus Sutra. Do you know that story? That when we say homage to the Dharmakaya, Vairochana, Buddha, like in the meal chant.
Yeah.
We say the 10 names of Buddha, but if you count them, there's 11, actually. And it originally, before Dogen, there were just 10, but Dogen just loves the Lotus Sutra. So he added in the name of the Lotus Sutra, the Lotus of the Wondrous Dharma, Mahayana Sutra, or the Sadharma Pundarika Sutra. It's the Lotus Sutra. And this phrase, remember this came up in Patrick's class too, right?
Yeah.
Literally it says that Shobutsu Nyorai Ichi Daiji Inen, which means all Buddha Tathagatas, one great matter, causes and conditions. And I think it's really like, you can understand it as the one great matters, causes and conditions. The one great matter is Buddha, in this case, Buddha appearing in the world. And the Lotus Sutra says, the one great matters, causes and conditions are the Buddha's wish to benefit beings, the Buddha's wish to open beings to reality, and there's these, I think, 10 of these causes and conditions of the one great matter, of Buddha's appearance in the world. And it's basically like the feeling of them is it's like the Bodhisattva vow, like this compassionate wish to benefit beings, that's what brings Buddha into the world. So here it has the Lotus Sutra is the one great matters, causes and condition of Buddha Tathagatas. Like that. We also see this, we also in Zen we say the Bodhisattva precepts are the one great matters, causes and condition of Buddha's appearing in the world. It's on the bottom of the blood vein document that you receive when you receive the precepts. It says this quote from the Lotus Sutra. The Lotus Sutra is the king, the great master of the sutras expounded by Shakyamuni Buddha. All other sutras and dharmas are its subjects and relations. Or, all other sutras and dharmas are its servants and retinue. So it's kind of making the Lotus Sutra into a teacher and saying that all the other sutras are kind of serving the Lotus Sutra. The words of the Lotus Sutra are genuine. Other sutras that include skillful means are not necessarily the essential teachings or the original thought of the Buddha. To rely on the words in other sutras in order to criticize the Lotus Sutra is upside down. Without the influence of the Lotus Sutra, there can be no other sutras. Other sutras assemble to take refuge in the Lotus Sutra. This sutra speaks of those who cannot hear the name of the three treasures. Thus know that the merit of the three treasures is unequaled. I think this is Dogen getting a little off on a little sidetrack of how much he loves the Lotus Sutra. Praising it, and then maybe saying that, so therefore this one little line that he's quoting is like a mega line. Yeah. It's like super, super true and important that karmic conditions prevent us from hearing the name of the three treasures. We could say much less taking refuge in them. And again, we could talk about these karmic conditions, unwholesome conditions, vexed by their unwholesome karma, we could hear as the obscurations that seem to veil or block Buddha nature, prevent us from hearing the name of the three treasures and taking refuge in it.
That's the point I was going to make before about karma, that I like to try and, when I think of my karma, I think that my karma is actually just the sum of all the different beings that have interacted with me.
Yeah.
And so it's all of them, it's all the different beings that interacted with me that have made it possible for me karmically to be here.
Yeah.
And for people who aren't having any contact with the Dharma, it's all not just their personal life and the things there, it's all the beings that have obstructed them.
Yes.
And I just
think nice point.
It's a really nice way to look at it.
Yes.
Otherwise we can get a little caught into like, ooh, I must have done good stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and poor them. Yeah, why didn't they make more effort or something?
So if we think of karma in a much more
big web,
then we can feel real gratitude that we're here because of this bigger kind of karma.
And also, on the negative side, we could say, when we get all caught up in our stuff and seem to bring upon ourselves a lot of suffering unnecessarily, we can say that too is not exactly us doing that. It's all the conditions. Therefore, and ultimately speaking, there's no blame.
Yeah.
It's almost like everything that we're doing every moment, we have to be doing it just that way, according to everything that led up to this point. And we could say ourself and others, but I guess if we look more carefully, we say, but there is no actual self. It's only others. Others meaning like not just people, but the whole world. Every experience that's happened to us creates our response every moment. It's very, in a way, I think that view is very relieving because it takes away a lot of self-deprecation. There isn't really a self to deprecate or blame. And it's also kind of scary because it means that we're not in control. There's no self that's like, well, I'm going to decide to do it this way now. But we did just decide to do it this way. And we could say that's because all the conditions came together in such a way as to shift it this way. And you could say one of the great conditions for this way being towards liberation is the three treasures. Mm-hmm. The more we let the three treasures kind of influence us, the more we start moving in the direction of liberation. Mm-hmm. Can we choose to let them? Maybe not. But we can hear such a thing. That's a condition. The world honored one said in the Dhammapada, and this is also quoted from the Dhammapada in the Abhidharma Kosha, many of you are fearful of suffering and take refuge in mountains, gardens, forests, under trees, or in shrines. And the other translations say, and I think it's probably more accurate, take refuge in the spirits of mountains, gardens, forests, under trees, or spirits of shrines. And I think this is just part of the Indian culture and, you know, maybe like Shinto culture too, right? Of kind of like nature spirits.
Wasn't that what the Buddha did? I mean, he became a monk, a wandering monk.
How is that? You mean living under trees?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why I think it's not so much taking refuge in living under a tree.
It didn't work for him.
Oh, well, I think here we're talking about more like deities that live in trees and mountains and forests. I don't think the Buddha, I mean, he grew up maybe in sort of Brahmin culture, but if that's what you mean, more like a kind of pre-Buddhist religion did have, you know, lots of deities that are connected, and most cultures have that too, actually. Like spirits that dwell in the mountains, and of course these cultures mix with Buddhism, so even in Buddhist countries, you have making offerings to the mountain spirit. Even Dogen, who's writing this, has like a, at Aheiji, Dogen's temple, there's Hakusan, the white mountain, that's like the mountain of that temple. There's like a shrine to the mountain deity. but I think maybe the difference is, they're not taking refuge in the mountain spirit. Mm-hmm. You can make offerings to it as kind of like, let the mountain be peaceful and not erupt and destroy this temple. You know,
so
like
is that where there's the crossover with Shinto?
I think this actually is probably related to Shinto. I haven't heard this thing of Dogen setting up a shrine to the mountain spirit there. It might come from Shinto, but I think also Shinto's in Japan, originated in Japan, right? But also, I think China has traditions like that too, of nature.
This is Dogen's. Well, it's not his.
It's not, it's old Indian, actually. So India, China, and Japan has this. And I was thinking, well, we don't really, in America, have these nature spirits, but we might.
And the Indian tribes too.
Indian tribes, for sure. Yeah, they do. But modern, say, maybe Christianity, actually, maybe at least the modern Christianity maybe try to really steer away from nature spirits. I think early Christianity maybe did have this kind of pagan thing, and at some point they really wanted to separate them and call that heretical. But I was thinking in our culture, we maybe do have, like, modern spirits are like kind of like technology.
I think that's one of the criticisms of Christianity, was that it separated nature.
Yeah.
And that's our nature. It's because it separated from nature. But before, when they started as a pagan religion, they had all those deity kind of things.
Yeah.
Unofficially. Unofficially, I think we do, like, it's always tempting to, like, ask for rain or name a hurricane, like personify the weather.
Yeah,
like,
it's true.
All that.
Yeah, whether we really truly believe it, if someone were to push us on that, maybe not, but we, almost like as a folk kind of rituals, we maybe do believe certain things, and even maybe like superstitions.
Yeah.
Like, don't step on the crack or you'll break your mother's back.
Yeah.
We had in school, that was this phrase, when you're walking on the sidewalk and there's the cracks, don't step on the crack.
Yeah, sports is full of superstition.
Sports,
You know, Notre Dame, they go out, they hit the wall, or they hit the rock, and then other teams hit the wall.
Mm-hmm.
Some people grow the beard if they're winning, and then they cut it if they're not.
So we and then I think these things we wouldn't necessarily call spirits, like technology, almost like the spirit of the internet or an iPod or something. It's almost like there's a spirit in there. We almost worship it too, right?
Yeah.
And
computer.
Siri. Yes, Siri. And I think another one is medicine. We almost like there's a spirit. We believe in the power of modern medicine, right? And we feel like I take refuge in that, the spirit in this. I believe this will heal me more than like Buddha, right?
Yeah.
And so,
gotta take the pills.
Yeah. So I think all these things, there's nothing wrong with, but I think maybe the point that's being made with is it a supreme refuge? Any of these things, right?
Yeah.
These folk customs, technology or modern medicine, they're great, right? But are we taking refuge in them as like the supreme reliance? Mm. And some people maybe do, consciously or unconsciously.
Well, and the arts. I mean, the arts, think of the power of dance, which is nonverbal communication, and the superstitions in the theater.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just lots and lots of them.
But
the power of any work of art.
Yeah. Has some spirit in it, right?
Some would take refuge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Music.
By the way.
Yeah.
And it may be anything that moves us, and especially moves us mysteriously, because that's what these mountain spirits, I think, like, I have some feeling in the mountain here. And maybe in the old days it was like, especially in the dark at night, I'm a little scared in the mountain, but if I make an offering to this mountain spirit, I feel safer, right? So World Honor One said, many of you are fearful of suffering. Particularly, that's what I think is being pointed to. We're afraid of suffering, so therefore, to relieve it, we take refuge in the spirits of mountains, gardens, forests, or tree spirits, or shrine spirits. Like, maybe of shrines of nature deities. This refuge is neither excellent nor valuable. You cannot be liberated from suffering by taking refuge in them. On the other hand, if you take...
So is it the Dhammapada that says that whole first line?
Yeah, and
then the next paragraph is Dogen's comment?
I think it continues, Dhammapada, actually. I have to look for this. The Abhidhamma Kosha quotes the whole thing, so yeah. On the other hand, if you take refuge in Buddha and take refuge in Dharma and Sangha, you can always abide in the Four Noble Truths. With this wisdom, you always observe and understand suffering and the arising of suffering. You know how to go beyond suffering forever. You know the Eightfold Path. This refuge is the most excellent and most valuable of all. You will certainly become free from all suffering by taking this refuge. Kind of standard, simple point, but particularly we could to hear these early Buddhist teachings about looking for safety from suffering in some sort of external spirit versus the understanding of the Four Noble Truths was really, I think in Buddha's time, it was a quite radical thing, because it was all about the so-called pre-Hindu religion was all about deities and offering to them to be safe. And this was more this inward turning, right? Let's, how does suffering really work? Can we really rely on anything outside ourselves?
There's a caste system, and
that's part of the law of reality, but it's actually not based on investigation of how things really are. Yeah. So the Four Noble Truths, though they sound so simple, I think to make that the heart of one's dharma was a big shift in the Buddha's time. That's really, let's try to really understand what suffering is. Oh, suffering is not just that we're afraid, period. It's based on grasping a self, and therefore that's part of the origin of suffering, is the craving that comes from grasping a separate, independent self, the five skandhas as a self. And then there's the cessation of suffering, is the cessation of that craving and grasping. And then there's this path that's not actually just making offerings to deities. The path is actually right view, right intention, right conduct, right speech, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, right livelihood. Very practical. And that's like a different kind of refuge. So Dhammapada was supposed to be one of the Buddha's earliest teachings.
I'm glad we're past sacrificing things.
Sometimes we maybe sacrifice ourselves, put ourselves on a cushion till we wither away. We don't sacrifice others. Yeah, Buddha was, that was happening. There were animal sacrifices in Buddha's time. And he said, that's totally not only missing the point, you're causing this cruelty to beings who aren't even part of your religion. They have to suffer for your belief, right? So kind of very down to earth teaching here. This, the refuge in the Three Treasures, means abiding in the Four Noble Truths, this paragraph.
So is the refuge in the, so I thought I heard you say refuge in the understanding of the Four Noble Truths.
Yeah.
And is that the same, is that refuge in Dharma?
Yeah.
And is refuge in Buddha awareness, our awareness then refuge in Buddha? I mean, is there a distinction between the two in that same respect?
Well, in a way, we could say that this is bringing up the Dhammapada and the Abhidharma Kosha are like pre-Mahayana teachings, right? We could say foundational Buddhism, before Buddha nature came on the scene, right? That the teaching or discovery of Buddha nature. So in the early foundational teachings, it's more like Shakyamuni Buddha is the Buddha. Like when he's alive, he is alive teaching this, right? He's the Buddha, so you take refuge in. He's like the example that it works, right? We might say. And the Dharma is the Four Noble Truths. Is in a way Buddhism, one of the Buddha's central Dharma teachings. And the Sangha is those who are putting it into practice and enacting it so that it proving that it works, at least.
In your own life.
Yeah, in your own life. Mm-hmm. And again, we could say the Dharma the Dharma of Scripture and the Dharma of Realization. We could say the Dharma of Scripture is like our Friday morning chant, setting in motion the wheel of Dhamma, where there's a teaching that defines the Four Noble Truths. And then the Dharma of Realization would be like understanding. In fact, in the sutra it says, this suffering must be understood. That's like the practice that you do with this teaching called suffering. You understand it, and then the origin of suffering must be abandoned. That's the practice that you do with the Second Noble Truth. And the cessation of suffering must be realized. That's the enactment. That's the Dharma of Realization of the Third Noble Truth. And then the path leading to the cessation must be followed. That's the Dharma of Realization or practice. It's kind of built into the sutra very nicely. It starts with the Dharma of Scripture, kind of let's define the Four Noble Truths, and then it ends with let's have a practice to enact each of the Four Noble Truths. But all of that, we could say, fits into the Dharma treasure. And the Buddha, in that case, might just say, we could say Shakyamuni Buddha, or we could say the complete realization. Also, that's in the sutra too, at the end, where the Buddha says, as long as these three aspects of the Four Noble Truths were not fully realized, I didn't claim to be the Buddha. But when they were, then I did claim to have realized the perfect awakening, supreme in the world. We could say Buddha is like the final fruition of the Four Noble Truths, and Sangha, we could say, is though he's practicing the Eightfold Path to realize the end of suffering, but that aren't fully Buddha yet. Mm-hmm. They're on the path. And because the Mahayana then talks about the Buddha is the final fruition and the Sangha is the Bodhisattvas, mm-hmm. which are like on the path to Buddhahood. The world-honored one clearly taught all sentient beings not to take refuge in mountain deities, demon spirits, and so on, or in shrines of those outside the way with their fear of suffering. It's not possible to be liberated from various sufferings by taking refuge in those. People follow the crooked teachings of those outside the way and follow the ways of cows, deer, demons, those who practice not speaking, those who practice not hearing, dogs, chickens, peacocks, or those who put ash on their bodies, grow long hair, sacrifice sheep on the seasonal rites after chanting mantras, worship the fire in the fourth month, or bow to the wind on the seventh day. So I think this is just a list of Indian practices. Yeah, sadhus and ascetic practices. And I don't know all the details, but there's this sutra of the in the Pali Canon called the Dog Duty Ascetic. Mm-hmm. And it lists a bunch of these, and the Dog Duty Ascetic is the practice apparently was being followed in the Buddha's time of acting like a dog as a kind of renunciate practice. I mean, like you walk around on all fours as a renunciate, as a kind of, and with no clothes, and you eat off the ground without using your hands. That might sound silly to us, but we saw some stuff in India that was not quite like that, but people do all kinds of stuff to kind of like, I think mainly it's about like taming desire. Mm-hmm. It's like living in this really like uncomfortable way, like self-mortification, in order to give up comfort, maybe attachment to comfort. Maybe there's some value, but it's a little off track. We don't understand the Four Noble Truths.
Is that where the quote "We're going to the dogs" comes from?
maybe, and that might be the ways of cow, deer, and dogs, chickens, and peacocks. Maybe just acting like all these animals as a spiritual practice, and there's not speaking is definitely a practice. not hearing, maybe just ignoring people when they listen to you because you're so beyond. Putting ash on the body, you still see that in India. You know, never cutting the dreadlocks, sacrificing animals, worshipping the fire, and the other translation, this bowing to the wind on the seventh day, is another comment says, it's actually, it's the literal Chinese is air medicine, so I think it's more like, according to these footnotes, is like fasting, taking only air as nourishment for 7 days would be another translation. You know, consuming only air for 7 days, I think, is maybe better than bowing to the wind on the seventh day. but there might be a practice of bowing to the wind on the seventh day to be free from suffering. Right? And they dedicate numerous flowers to devas and pray for attaining what they desire. There's no reason why these practices would cause liberation. Thus, people suffer in vain without receiving wholesome results. This is not recommended by those who are wise.
That's not like fighting words, you know, like in those days, you know, like someone who didn't have like a war or that, it's like insulting other religions.
In a way, yeah, yeah. And you can read, you know, in the Pali Sutras, the Buddha does have lots of conversations with people from other religions, and usually he's not like, he doesn't get angry at them, but sometimes he's pretty direct. Or they have, it's like religious debate.
Yeah.
So I think it's a good-hearted thing, but when you read the sutras, my feeling is that the Buddha was like kind of an intense character, and he would, and I think because he really realized liberation, he's like, I want to help, especially help religious spiritual practitioners, because they're already have realized that they're suffering and they're looking for a way out. They are, you know, most possible to help. So that's really, and some of them were very dedicated to practicing these ways that aren't really working for a long time.
Yeah.
So in order to convince them to change their whole practice, he maybe had to be pretty strong sometimes.
Yes. Yeah.
And he went through it too.
He went through it too, yeah. Exactly. He tried a lot of stuff first. Before the Eightfold.
Speak from experience.
Path. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thus make sure you don't mistakenly fall into such crooked paths. Crooked, we might say, it sounds, you know, wrong or something, but we might also say, like, it's just a path that leads directly. These paths are going kind of like roundabout, windy paths. They're not going to be the fastest way. Crooked paths. Do not take refuge in any practices that are similar to these. Human birth is difficult to acquire, and Buddha Dharma is rarely encountered. Do not spend your life in the company of demons and waste many lifetimes among those who have crooked views. This would be deplorable. Instead, immediately take refuge in the three treasures of Buddha Dharma and Sangha, and not only be liberated from all suffering, but also attain enlightenment. Yeah, strong words. And when I hear that kind of thing, I also feel like not just being kind of like blind follower, yes, Dogen, I will do what you say, but more like let's really investigate. If someone's going to speak this strongly, is it just like a skillful means to kind of talk us into something? Or is it more like let's really investigate the principles? And in fact, these early sutras are so beautiful when Buddha's having these debates, because he never just says, you guys are crazy and wrong, you should follow me. Yeah, exactly. It's not like the presidential debates where it's just attack of the others. It's very reasoned.
Yeah.
And they're beautiful conversations. And the Buddha often will do it by asking questions instead of just saying it's like this. The Buddha will say, well, in this, you know, dog duty practice that you do, have you realized the cessation of suffering? And, well, no, but it's going to eventually. And the Buddha will keep questioning, well,
yes.
What makes you think that it will? You know, and the person themselves comes to the conclusion. I think the Buddha is very skillful speaker, so you never feel like he's totally convincing. He's just using logic and reasoning, like Nagarjuna does, to kind of point out these flaws in other unexamined practices and views. Yeah. And then the person comes to the conclusion on their own. Mm-hmm. And it says, thank you for pointing me down this path. Mm-hmm. I kind of realized it on my own, and therefore it's not blind faith. I've actually come to see. The Rarity Sutra, or the Rare Occurrence Sutra, says, even if you guided the four continents and the six deva realms of desire and helped all beings there to attain the arhat fruit, the merit could not be compared with that of helping one person to take refuge in the three treasures. Literally it says, helping one person to receive the three treasures. Similar. And then Dogen says, the four worlds, or four continents, means the eastern, western, southern, and northern continents. This is like Indian Buddhist cosmology, right? We're in the southern continent of Jambudvipa, the Rose Apple Island. The north continent, Uttarakuru, is where the teaching of the three vehicles cannot reach. You can read all these things in the sutras. You know, there's these, in this cosmology, there's these continents where beings are really I think the northern continent, people are really violent, and they can't hear the three treasures. To teach beings there and help them to become arhats would be an extraordinary thing. The merit, however, is not even close to the merit of teaching and helping one person to take refuge in the three treasures. Also, the six heavenly realms of devas are where there are few who attain the way. Even if you would help them to attain the four fruits, that's stream enter, once returner, non-returner, arhat, it cannot compare with the great and deep merit of helping one person to take refuge in the three treasures.
Is that what's said in the Diamond Sutra too?
In the Diamond Sutra, it does do this merit comparison thing. Yeah, yeah. But there, in that case, it's like, the merit of all these great practices is not equal to hearing one line of the Diamond Sutra, which is the teaching of emptiness. So I think in that case, the point of all those comparisons is that realizing emptiness is so much greater than making countless offerings and so on. But in this case, I thought it was a little funny because he's saying you're helping these people realize complete liberation of, that's where the arhat is, totally free from suffering. And of course, to be an arhat, you have to take refuge in the three treasures. That's what it's completely taking refuge in the three treasures. So he's saying it's better to help one person just take refuge in the three treasures than to help somebody not only do that, but also realize this fruition of arhat. And so I wondered about the logic there. But I thought, well, maybe it's just saying that maybe one way to understand this would be like just helping one person enter the path is more valuable than someone who's already on the path kind of coming to the fruition of the path. Yeah. Almost because they're going to do it, they'll do it on their own anyway. Yeah. We're helping them do it, but once they're on the path will carry them. But if someone hasn't found the path yet, to help them just take refuge in the three treasures is like the entrance, the gateway, right? So once you're in the gateway, then in a way, things take care of themselves.
Lost souls, as you would say in Christianity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Help them find an entrance.
Yes.
Thinking the refuge is your safe place.
And it's a safety. And then there's teachings like, once you just take refuge, and by, you know, not just mouthing the words, but knowing what that means, and actually...
And then taking refuge in a safe sangha.
Yeah, well, that's part of refuge.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Then you're free from a lot of suffering.
Yes.
And maybe that's more important, even though you're not free from all suffering. But that could be more important than somebody who's already free of a lot of suffering, just finishing off the project.
Yeah. Is there a difference in the deva realms or in the person thing? Or are persons part of the deva realms?
it's technically a different realm in the six realms, right? There's devas, the god realm, and then there's the jealous wannabe gods who are not quite gods, but they're almost the fighting gods, right? Yeah. And then there's the human realm, is a different realm. But that's where we hang out mostly. And then the animal realm and the hungry ghost realm and the hell realm, right? So and I think generally they say like these upper realms of gods and humans, devas and humans, are both can hear Dharma. I think they usually say that the lower realms don't have access to that so much. Again, we give these teachings to the crickets.
There's the Buddha in the crickets, but they're not able to hear it.
Yeah, they don't hear it in words. I think they maybe animals do actually pick up some Dharma by the way we treat them.
Yeah.
Like kindness is a kind of entrance to Dharma. When we love an animal, they feel that love, and that's, I could say that's Dharma. But they're not going to get like Dharma teachings. But apparently, the devas understand Sanskrit and English and stuff because the Buddha would teach them.
So one human, one person is worth more than X million devas who have already taken refuge.
Oh, well, that's interesting. Yeah, and also, yeah, it's just limiting devas on this one, on this north continent, actually, right? Oh, here it says the four continents and the six deva realms. One person, yeah. So there might be actually something, actually that might be part of the point too, is that helping one person enter the path is better than helping deva realm gods realize the fruit of arhat. And why would that be? I don't know, but maybe because the devas have very comfy lives. Yeah. They're like super comfortable. That's part of the story, is that devas have very little suffering and they live these lifespans of billions of years, whereas humans have more suffering. We need Dharma more. We might hear it like that. We need the three treasures more than the devas.
And then we're more receptive to the refuge, to the way out.
Yeah, because we're suffering more.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we need more bodhisattvas than God.
Yeah. And I don't know if there's any stories of gods becoming bodhisattvas. Maybe not. Mm-hmm. And generally they also say, like, even though the devas enjoy their lives actually more than humans, the Buddhist take is like, we should rather wish to be born in a human realm than a god realm, because, like what Stan says, because we're suffering a little bit more, so we actually have some impetus to practice.
Right, exactly.
Where the gods have a really hard time.
It's too good.
Yeah, it's too good.
That sounds good, but we like it here.
Exactly. Although in the sutras they do say some of these devas hear the Buddha's teaching and they realize the way. So it's interesting exploring some of these, you know, the old world view in these essays and trying to apply it to our modern times. So thanks for being here. We dedicate the merit of our gathering to all suffering beings everywhere. May they find peace, harmony, and happiness, and refuge in a path of wisdom and compassion that doesn't lead to violence and harm. May all those who died and were injured in the 9/11 attacks find their way wherever they are now to a path of peace and wisdom and compassion. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to be coming.